Thank you. Thank you. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare. quotations given by Krishna Das, Kaviraj Goswami, taken from Srimad Bhagavatam. So, today I thought what we'll do is try and study the practical aspect of the Lord's appearance, of course, in relationship with the actual religious and philosophical and the, if you like, the relationship to the general quest for God, which goes on in this material world. So, of course, the claim of the Krishna conscious movement is that the philosophy of Lord Chaitanya is the highest philosophy. There is no other higher philosophy than that which was preached by Lord Chaitanya and his followers. This is a very momentous claim and has to be substantiated by scientific study. So, therefore, just like when we were debating last night on the different conflicting philosophies between atheism and deism, and I thought that we could study also Lord Chaitanya and that life. So, it's natural that people want to approach the Absolute Truth. As Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur very nicely says, that the phenomenon of attraction is often found to set to tempt sentient beings to enjoy the variegated situation which is opposed to undifferentiated monism. People are so much apt to indulge in transitory speculation, even when they are to educate themselves on a situation which lies beyond their experience and jurisdiction. So the tendency of everyone in the material world is to speculate about God. That's a natural tendency. It's something which is cannot be separated. Even when we use the word atheist, it's also a worship of God because it's a denial of God. Denial of God is also another God-conscious activity. Just like Kamsa was Krishna-conscious in denial. So you can also be God-conscious in denial. Why do people have to deny God? Because He's there. Simple as that. If God wasn't there, we wouldn't have to deny Him. Just like if you had a disease and you have to deny it. Well, why do you have to deny it? Because you've got it. It's there. You're trying to deny it to be happy. But the fact of the matter, the thing is there. If you want to deny God, the only reason you have to deny God is because He's unavoidable. God is unavoidable in every aspect of life, because ultimately what is the meaning of God? Of course, in Greek, the word can be translated into controller, that which controls. So let's take the idea of God as a controller. So anything which is being controlled means that there is some higher authority. In other words, it's illogical to say that control or order comes out of disorder. It doesn't make sense to say that order. If there's some order in creation, that means someone ordered it, isn't it? Someone ordered it. If there's any intelligence in the universe, even if it's only a small bit, that means someone intelligent put it there. You see? Just like if there's any design in this creation, it means there has to be a designer of some sort. Whether you say it's a human being, whether you say it's a void energy that just accidentally does things, whether you say it's just some sort of chance happening. So the point is that anyone with logic intelligence, of course animals cannot be logical, so we don't expect animals to understand God. But generally, the human being, what is the meaning of the human being? Is that he has power of discrimination. He can discriminate between something which is intelligent and something which is not intelligent. So the fact that it takes big intelligence to study the universe means the universe must be intelligent. Isn't it? It's not every old dimbo who understands physics, who understands nuclear science, who understands aerodynamics. And therefore we can understand that the people who are actually studying nuclear physics, nuclear science, who are studying quantum mechanics, who are studying all of these things, they're intelligent. Now the fact that they're intelligent means that it's intelligent people who study those things. What does that tell you? It tells you that the thing they're studying must be very intelligent. Because in order to study it, you need to be intelligent. Isn't it? So, if nature itself is extremely complex, it means you need a complex brain to study it, which means you need to be intelligent. So, in that way, we can understand that the cosmic manifestation is supremely complex. It's supremely complex. And therefore, when we talk about religion, we have to actually talk about the scientific study of God. Religion is not a sentimental adjustment of the mind, as is given by modern dictionaries, that religion is a type of faith. There is nothing to do with faith in religion, in the real sense. In the beginning, there may be a little faith required, because there's no intelligence. You see? When there's no intelligence, you require faith. Just like, if I go to a professor, in the beginning of my school days, I need to have faith in what he's saying, because I don't know what he's saying. But once I actually know what he's saying, my faith disappears. It becomes conviction. So therefore, we actually challenge that in Krishna consciousness, you don't require any faith. It's not required. In the neophyte state, you do require faith. You do require faith. That's why, because in the neophyte state, one does not have realization. That realization of the absolute truth is not there because in the beginning stages of spiritual life, one is very simple. And these simple activities that we've been doing in the material world has immersed us in an ocean of ignorance. This ocean of ignorance, of course, is manifested in our particularly material body and our material consciousness. So this process, so basically when we look into philosophy, we understand that in order to understand philosophy, in order to study God, we require outside help. We require outside help. This is the first basic principle of studying any philosophy. You go to a philosopher. Just like when Prabhupada met Professor Joukowsky. Kutovsky. He met Professor Kutovsky. And Prabhupada, basically, of course, this guy was a very intelligent, mundane professor, atheist. So Prabhupada immediately pointed out something extremely, extremely valid to the professor. He said that you are following Lenin, and I am following Krishna. What is the difference? So, when the atheists challenge, they are still following someone. You will find that everyone is following someone. This fellow is a big atheist, but he's following Lenin. We are following Krishna. The point of it is that everyone has to have outside help. Everyone has to have shelter of some form or other. That shelter may come in the form of taking shelter of some other philosopher. It may come in the form of taking shelter of some mundane leader. It may come in the form of taking shelter of some peers or higher authority of some kind. But the basic principle of all knowledge is that one takes some kind of shelter. So whether it's Lenin's philosophy, or capitalism, or whether it's spiritualism, it's all different types of shelter. So when we say, when someone says that I don't believe in taking shelter of God, yes, they may not believe in taking shelter of God, but they have taken shelter of something else. You see? They have taken shelter. They may have substituted God with taking shelter in capitalism, greediness. They may have taken shelter of socialism. They may have taken shelter in sex life. They may have taken shelter in anything. But one thing will be sure, that the dharma of the soul, or the function of the soul, is always to take shelter. So the basic principle of spiritual life is the first principle which Lord Chaitanya taught, which was very nicely expressed by Lord Chaitanya when he was coming in first association of the spiritual master. The first thing which Lord Chaitanya said about his spiritual master, he said, my spiritual master says that I am a great fool. That I am a great fool. And Lord Chaitanya was explaining that my spiritual master taught me such a great fool that he was saying that you are such a fool, you should just chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Now Lord Chaitanya was one of the greatest philosophers of his time. He defeated the greatest scholars such as the Digvijaya. He defeated many great philosophers. And Lord Chaitanya, of course, was an incarnation of the Supreme is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there's no question of the vastness of his knowledge. But at the same time, this is the wonderful contribution of the incarnation of Lord Chaitanya, that he came to show from the practical demonstration of being a devotee that what is the highest knowledge? The highest knowledge is actually to surrender. Now, in the material world, that science is not understood, because in the material world, the very nature of this material world is everyone is competing with each other to gain something. We are all in competition with each other. We may individually be in competition, or we may be as a group in competition. We may be in various shapes and forms, but all of us are in competition with each other in order to lord it over the material energy, in order to exploit matter. So therefore, when it comes to knowledge, then also there is always competition. You will find that in the material world, there is constant change, there is constant shifting of the goalposts in order for one to pursue different types of knowledge. In other words, there is no knowledge in the material world. There is no knowledge, because what we see is really just different types of speculations being constantly changed. So this is actually something which was already dealt with thousands of years ago. Of course, now more and more, all science is doing really is accumulating so many speculations and then throwing them out because they found better ones. And then 10 years down the road, they throw out that lot and they bring in some new ones. So this has been going on since the beginning of so-called scientific pursuit. So therefore, in Vedic culture, this was already dealt with, because if one studies intelligently, one can understand that there are certain things about the body which do not allow it to have knowledge. The body is not a very good instrument for knowledge. Because in order for you to gain knowledge, in other words, first of all, if you understand the principle, then we are born into ignorance. If people cannot understand that principle, that we are born into ignorance, then they cannot even begin the path of knowledge. So first of all, if we understand, every one of us are born into ignorance. So therefore, any knowledge that we have is something which we've got from outside. That's why we call it information. In. It comes in and then it formates. Isn't it? It's not outformation, it's information. It's coming in. So that thing which is coming into us, that is called information. But if we are to depend on that knowledge, then we have to understand that the instruments that are bringing it in, are they perfect? In other words, if we say knowledge can be received by hearing, is our hearing perfect? Is our seeing perfect? Is our association perfect? So therefore, this verse is given. Brahma pramada vipralipsa karana patava arsha vigna vakye nahi dosha isav. Mistakes, illusion, cheating, and defective perceptions are there in the material world. That everyone in the material world, because they are born into a material body, automatically are in a diseased condition. Diseased condition means that my senses are imperfect. Because my senses are imperfect, why are they imperfect? Because they're limited. My senses are limited, therefore I have a tendency to make mistakes, therefore I have a tendency to be illusion, therefore I have a tendency to cheat. So this tendency to commit mistakes, to be illusion, this cheating propensity is caused by defective perception. So therefore, that how can you know that's true? You can know it's true because everyone gains their knowledge by hearing. The reason you have to hear is because you don't already have knowledge. You see? Why do you have to hear knowledge from anywhere? So in other words, let's forget where we're hearing our knowledge from. But at least we should understand the fact that I have to hear knowledge means it's because I don't have it. So knowledge is something which is not automatically accessible. It is something which has to come from help, from outside. Therefore, one can conclude that everyone is completely dependent on outside help. Now, the next question is that who are you going to take help from? Isn't it? Because if you agree with the factor that you need help, then you have to decide, well, who am I going to take help from? So naturally, in our childhood, we take help from teachers. Those teachers took help from their teachers. We took help from their teachers. We took help from their teachers. So any source of knowledge can be traced back to an original source. And therefore, the process of getting spiritual knowledge and the process of getting material knowledge are exactly the same. The only difference is the source. So that's why in this verse, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is explaining that as it says here, by my causeless mercy be enlightened in truth about my personality, manifestations, qualities, and pastimes. So therefore, knowledge has to come from God. Knowledge has to come from God. Why does knowledge have to come from God? Yes, because God is the source of everything, but also because we should understand that God is the only one who is perfect. He's the only one who's perfect in the absolute sense. Our perfection in the material world does not exist. But what we can say is, relatively speaking, I'm better than him. Isn't it? The only thing any mundane scientist, any mundane philosopher can say, I'm better than the other guy. It's the only claim to fame that he has. He can't say that he's better than anyone outside of this planet, because we have no reference to that. So all he can do is say, one scientist can outdo another scientist, can outdo another scientist, can. So this is the way that mundane knowledge goes on. So it's not knowledge. It's just different ignorant people being a little bit better than each other. That's all that so-called knowledge is in the material world. Therefore, scientists of the Vedic age did not take much, did not take much heed to speculation. As a matter of fact, speculation is a very unscientific way of studying truth. Because if something is defective, what's the use in using it? You see, if something is intrinsically defective, then there's no use in using it. So therefore, in order to enlighten, this Vedic process is completely different. It is not an ascending process, it is a descending process. And therefore, this is why this knowledge is directly given by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, either directly in his own form or through his agents. And therefore, Krishna is saying, by my causeless mercy, be enlightened in truth. So be enlightened in truth about my personality. So this is the one thing which is the most important thing to understand in this universe. The most important thing to understand in the universe is who created it. There can't be anything more important than that. Because unless you understand who created the universe, you'll never understand the universe. You see, you must understand who created it. Most materialists want to know why it's created or how it's... They don't even know want to know why it's created. They want to know how it's created. They want to know how it's created because they want to subjugate the material energy under their exploitive idea. In other words, they want to bring material energy under their measuring jurisdiction. They want to be able to measure it, to quantify it, to qualify it, and to utilize it in their, for their particular interest. But, as Krishna says, that this material energy, that this is mama maya dharatavya, it is my energy. Maya dakshena prapiti suyate charachara itunaya kataya jagati paribhati. This maya, this maya-dakshena, this material energy, is working under my direction, under his direction. Therefore, to understand material energy is impossible without the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, the Supreme Lord comes in the form of Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya comes in the Kali Yuga because Krishna has already appeared 5,000 years ago and has demonstrated his personality. But still, it is very, very difficult for the tiny living entities to understand Krishna. Therefore, in order to explain Krishna, Krishna comes himself again. So this is the wonderful nature of Lord Chaitanya's appearance, is that this appearance of Lord Chaitanya is that he comes, Krishna has come himself, in order to explain himself. So the Lord has come as the devotee. Previously, he has come as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the supreme autocratic dominator of the creation. Therefore, when Krishna comes into the material world, he performs amazing pastimes, which in themselves are even more bewildering to the conditioned souls. So as it says here, the innumerable forms of the Lord, such as Shyam Sundar, Narayan, Rama, and Gaurasundar, the color of these forms, his qualities as the responsive personality of Godhead, to pure devotees, and as impersonal Brahman to dry speculators. His uncommon activities like lifting Govardhan Hill, marrying more than 16,000 queens at the Walker, and entering the Rasa dance with the damsels of Braja, expanding himself in as many forms as there were damsels in the dance. These and innumerable other uncommon acts and attributes are all mysterious. Now, because they're mysterious, if something is a mystery, then people cannot take proper appreciation of that. People cannot actually get proper benefit from that. So therefore, one has to remove this mystery. So Lord Chaitanya has come to give the formula or the process of removing this mystical curtain. As it says in the Bhagavatam, that the Lord is covered by a mystical curtain. Just like sometimes the example is that in a theater, there may be so many things on the stage, but when the curtain is there, you can't see any of the things on the stage. As soon as the curtain is removed, then everything becomes wonderfully displayed. So similarly, this material energy is a great curtain of Maya. This curtain, actually, of course, the example is used like the clouds. The clouds are like a curtain of the sun. They keep the sun hidden. And therefore, until the clouds are removed, one cannot actually get benefit from the sun. You can get some benefit from the sun, just like now, I don't know, it's still cloudy, but there's some benefit. But the real benefit, all the benefit of the sun comes when the clouds are removed. Similarly, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is always there, and His energies are always there, and we are always there. But unfortunately, the relationship between us and Krishna is not always there. So what is stopping that relationship is this cloud of Maya, this fogginess in the brain. We all have a big fog going on in our head. You can see it every time you wake up, how foggy it is. And you're almost like trying to get through this fog. But just like if you're in a great ocean with a big fog, you need outside help. You need help. So this help comes in the form of Lord Chaitanya. He has descended, and He has not only descended, but He has brought with Him all of His paraphernalia, all of His devotees. They have also come. And He has come down to actually simply to do one thing, and that is to bestow His causeless mercy. Lord Chaitanya is the incarnation of causeless mercy. So, what is that causeless mercy of Lord Chaitanya? Now, in study of Lord Chaitanya, one can see that Lord Chaitanya came and, okay, He did some chanting and dancing, He did some wonderful pastimes, but what is the real causeless mercy of Lord Chaitanya? The real mercy of Lord Chaitanya is that He brought what no other incarnation has brought. There are many incarnations of God that have come. There are many philosophers that have come. There are many prophets. There are many great personalities who have come to this world. But the difference is that Lord Chaitanya brought one thing which they have not brought. And that thing which Lord Chaitanya brought, you can see it by studying all of the different philosophies on this planet. You will find that Lord Chaitanya came to reveal one thing, and that is that He came to give everyone a taste of rasa. You see, this science of rasa has never before been properly studied in philosophy. So what is rasa? This rasa is, in a material sense, we can try to study it as a certain type of taste. There's a certain type of taste. Now, if you study this factor of taste, you will find that all of the activities of the material world are done in order to give us different types of taste. Ultimately, if we see that everything we do it for taste. We do it for taste. Now, taste may come in the form of eating in the lovement, or it may come in the form of some type of exciting activity. It may come in the form of different types of sense gratification. But the highest taste which we get in the material world is actually sex life. Sex life is the highest taste. And therefore, unless religion deals with this principle of sex life, it can never succeed. You see? If you look at all religions, they all leave it alone. They leave sex life alone, because I remember one time the Pope was asked, can you have sex in heaven? He didn't know what to say. I mean, what do you say? Well, it's not really the place for sex, is it? That's not really an answer, because the principle of sex life is what makes the whole creation go on. You can see that if there's one principle why people don't take the spiritual life, it's sex life. You see? Most religions are trying to preach some sort of morality. They're trying to bring people to some sort of moral principle, and that moral principle is that you should be good, you shouldn't cheat, you shouldn't steal, you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that. So mostly if you find that most religions are negative, they're negative, and therefore the following of a religion, so the following of a religion is generally how good you are at abstaining from things, isn't it? Generally, if you're following a religion, you don't smoke, you don't drink, you don't engage in illicit sex, you don't go, you don't this, you don't that, you don't that. And if you study all the different types of religion, people are admired within the religion as to how good they are at abstaining from things. You know, the yogi sitting at an altar doesn't look at anything, doesn't breathe, doesn't eat, doesn't sleep. The idea of the Christian saints, they're all living in caves, emancipated. They were hadn't eaten for 40 days and 40 nights. And even when they talk of Lord Jesus Christ, there's always this emphasis that he went out into the desert and fasted and starved himself to death. So generally, people's idea of religion is always that you've got to go away and do some forms of what do you call it, abstaining. I think Radha Govinda is having some rasa with us today. Appearing and disappearing. So this idea of religion is always very unpalatable for most people, because it's seen as sort of depriving oneself of various kinds of necessities. The necessities of life. And therefore, there's always this idea of all these shrunken monks and nuns walking through the cloisters, sort of hanging on for their dear life, skin and bone, living in cotton sacks, and awakening to cold porridge, cold morning, and cold showers. And the general idea is that the more you can follow these kind of deprivations, isn't it? Yeah. These sort of deprivations, then the more you are spiritually advanced. You know, if you That's why even in our own philosophy we look towards renunciates and abstainers and people who are in control of their senses, who don't get agitated when they are on the situations that we get agitated in. So this is always the idea. But this type of understanding of religion is actually a negative idea, because the whole idea of religion is that religion means the relationship between the living entity and God. Therefore, it should be full of the highest happiness. Susukam, as Krishna said in the Bhagavad Gita, in the fourth chapter, that this knowledge is the king of all. It is the king of all education. It is the king of all education. It is the greatest science of education, because it gives direct perception of the self through realization. This direct perception of the self through realization. So this perception of the self and realization, what is that realization? That realization, of course, is called vijnana. There are two things which are there in Vedic literature. One is jnana, but the other one is vijnana. Vijnana means the practical realization of the knowledge of Vedic literature. So this practical realization, it gives direct realization of the self. It gives direct perception of the self. It is joyful. Joyful because God is the most important principle of God. The most important principle of God is at least he should be happy, isn't it? If God is not happy, then why did you bother going there? It's like if someone was performing all these austerities all your life, you finally got to the pearly gates, and you open the gates and there's God saying, "Oh, I feel miserable." So, therefore, this study of God has to be the study of the pleasure potency of God. You see, this has to be the study of the pleasure potency. There is no other potency of God that is as attractive. Philosophy about God, knowing how God creates universes or destroys universes, how he maintains universes, it's fine, it's good, it's nice. You know, there's billions of universes, they're all floating in space. Then the Lord manifests huge varieties within each of those universes, and then he impregnates billions and trillions of living entities, and we're one of those little living entities impregnated into this huge vast cosmos, and here we are struggling away with our mind, with our senses, with our mortgages, with our problems, with our rent. So all of it may be very wonderful to hear about, as in most religions, to hear about God is great. Yes, God is great. But the thing is that just simply studying God's greatness has never made anyone happy. It doesn't make you happy to know that someone is very great. It just makes you scared because you realize how small you are. So in many ways, it may bring about some sort of awe and veneration. If they bring this folding of the hands and praying to God. Generally, this, even the study of the greatness of God, tends to actually make you then think to yourself, well, if he's so great, he can do a few favors for me. You tend to actually then look at God and the idea that, okay, well, God's very great. Well, that's really good to know, because now I can give my whole shopping list of all the things that I haven't been able to gain in this material world. Now, let God gain them for me, and then I'll just hang around and wait till he gives them to me. So then most people's idea of worshipping God is in conflict, in cheating idea. Because generally the religions are where man has struggled in the material world to try to fulfill his desires, wasn't very successful, so then came along to God and get him to do it instead. That's all really religion is. It's just another extension of selfishness. We go to God gives us our daily bread. as if God's a baker. The idea that God should be baking loads of bread seems to be a very acceptable principle in some way. So therefore, what has Lord Chaitanya brought? Lord Chaitanya has brought a very different type of religion. A very different type of religion, because that dharma, which the dharma of Krishna consciousness, is that Lord Chaitanya has come to reveal a different way of worshipping God. A different way of worshipping God. What is that different way of worshipping God? That way of worshipping God which Lord Chaitanya has brought is that God Himself becomes dependent on your love. That is very, very difficult to understand. Of course, we can understand that God is not dependent. He is not dependent on anything. But at the same time, because there exists an individual relationship between us and God, that relationship is manifested in different types of rasa. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya has come to reveal the mysteries and depth of devotional service. So he has come in the mood of Srimati Radharani. He has come in the mood because the highest manifestation of this principle of rasa is the manifestation of Mahabhava. Mahabhava is the relationship between Radha and the attachment or the love of Radha to Krishna. And therefore, within this context, Lord Chaitanya has come in the mood of Srimati Radharani, because he wants to inundate the entire planet with this process of pure, unadulterated love for Krishna. So therefore, Lord Chaitanya is expounding this science through his devotee, the six Goswamis. And we see that Srila Rupa Goswami is explaining this power or this potency of Krishna consciousness. So he explains that there are the characteristics of this pure devotion. What is the characteristic of this pure devotion? One, pure devotional service brings immediate relief from all kinds of material distress. So that is the one of the principles of devotional service, is that it automatically relieves one from the causes of distress. You see? That is, in a sense, what everyone is looking for. The only thing that people really want is freedom from distress. People are not really interested in God. They're not really interested in religion. The reason people are not interested in God is because that to them God does not exist. You can't be interested in something which doesn't exist. Now you can say, well, God might exist, or you can say, I have faith that God does exist. But at this very moment in time, for us, God is not something that we actually have much interest in. We can say that we would like to have interest in God. We can say that one day we're going to have interest in God. We can say many things. But the actual reality is we are interested in ourselves. And therefore, the real attachment that one has to any religion is the benefit one gets from it. So therefore, that is why Lord Chaitanya has come to give immediate results. Just like in most religions, there's this idea that if you are good, if you perform pious activities and all of these other things, then at the time of death, because you did very, very good, you are going to go to heaven. But it's a bit risky waiting until you die, isn't it? Because if it didn't quite work, you may not go to heaven. So therefore, all of the religions that you see, they're always something you're going to gain in an afterlife, generally. Whereas Krishna consciousness brings immediate results. We can see that practically, that most of us are coming from sinful backgrounds, but because of contact with Krishna consciousness, immediately we are able to give up intoxication. Immediately we are able to give up immediately illicit sex, gambling, television, radio, newspapers, even newspapers. Well, not all of them, but at least we should give up newspapers. So, the thing is that because there is immediate relief. In Krishna consciousness, there is immediate relief. Now, there's immediate relief from all kinds of material distress. What are the causes of material distress? That one has to understand. What are the causes of material distress? Who can answer that one? What are they called? They're called pleasures. Pleasures. There's what we call adhyatmika klesha, adhibhautika klesha, adhidevika klesha. Now, all of these pleasures are inflicted upon us. Why? They're inflicted upon us because of our sinful activities. The reason that we suffer mental distress is because we have been bad boys. The reason we suffer bodily distress is because we've been bad girls. The reason we suffer from other living entities is because, you know, we have done some bad activities. So all of these various types of distress are different reactions from past activities. You see, any situation we're in right now is because of something we did in the past. Our whole body is a manifestation of things that we did in the past. You see? So therefore, our whole physical and psychological manifestation is all simply a reaction of sin. That's why it can't bring us any happiness. The only time that we gain any happiness is because we may have done a few pious activities. And luckily we did. Otherwise we'd be just suffering like anything. So therefore, we can understand that happiness and distress are various types of sinful reaction. So therefore, as soon as we begin devotional service, we automatically become relieved from more sinful activities than we could perform. You see, this is the power of devotional service that Lord Chaitanya has brought. It is so powerful that simply by once uttering Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna,
Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama,
one automatically becomes free from more sinful activities than you could have done in billions and billions and billions and billions of lifetimes. That's how powerful chanting Hare Krishna is. Now, you may say, that sounds very exaggerated. But at the same time, we have to accept God's word. You see, this knowledge is coming from God. And God is the one who created the entire material creation. And if He says that once chanting of His name can free you from all the reactions of all the sins that you've ever done, we have to accept it. So this is the power of chanting the name of God. But there's only one qualification which is required, and that is you chant out of love. So maybe that's the ingredient missing. But at least we can understand the potency of the Holy Name. Two, pure devotional service is the beginning of all auspiciousness. Why is it the beginning of all auspiciousness? You see? Again, because devotional service automatically puts one on the transcendental platform. On the transcendental platform, there is nothing inauspicious. There is only the spiritual world. So therefore, Krishna consciousness is the only process which is both the means and the end. It is not a means. Devotional service is not like performing some pious activities or doing some good, so so as you will get some material gain or some material benefit or even some spiritual benefit. No. Devotional service, number three, devotional service automatically puts one in transcendental pleasure. It automatically puts one in transcendental pleasure. So therefore, you automatically start to taste the nectar for which we are always anxious. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya said, Sankirtan movement is the prime benediction for humanity as well, because it spreads the rays of the benediction movement. It is the life of all transcendental knowledge, of all transcendental bliss. So, and it gives us a taste of that nectar for which we are always anxious. So that is the real essence of Lord Chaitanya. He has brought the nectar, that nectar for which we are hankering, birth after birth. We are hankering after that nectar, and we are trying to experience that nectar, because by nature we are honeybees. We are all honeybees. Everyone sitting in this room is honeybee. You see, we are honeybee, and we want the honey. If you see honeybees, they're not interested in anything else. They want the honey. They're after the honey. We also, every living entity wants the honey. But we are trying to get the honey from the wrong places. We are going to the nettles. We are going into the garbage heap. And we are trying to suck some honey out of bags of skin and bone and pus and mucus and bile and stool. We are trying to suck some honey from there, but there's no honey. There's no honey. In this material world, everything is inferior. So therefore, inferior honey is here. Not real honey. Inferior honey. But Lord Chaitanya has brought the pot of real honey. He's brought a big, big pot. It's so big, it fills the entire creation, this pot. And he is simply calling us, come on, Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago, wake up you sleeping honeybees. You have to wake up you sleeping honeybees and jump in this pot of honey. I am already drowning. I am drowning in this honey pot. Lord Chaitanya is drowning with all of his associates. If you read Chaitanya Bhagavat, Chaitanya Charitamrita, you will see, he is drowned there. So this drowning is there because Lord Chaitanya has not come to give anything but this pure honey of Akila Rasamrita Murti, the honey of love for Krishna. Krishna is the Akila Rasamrita Murti. He is the reservoir of all Rasamrita. This Rasamrita is that he is always enjoying Amrita, nectar. Krishna is always, just like now, he's with Radharani on the altar. We see he is enjoying nectar in his fruit. He is playing beautiful music. And that music is so captivating that it breaks the heart of the gopis. It breaks their heart. So breaks their heart means it makes them go mad in love. When they hear the notes coming from the flute of Krishna in their heart, They go mad. They become mad with ecstasy of love for Krishna. So similarly, this sound of the transcendental world has come down into this material world. This sound has come down in the chanting of Hare Krishna,
Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
So therefore, Lord Chaitanya has brought this nectar pot, and we can jump in this nectar pot, just like the bees, they jump in and drown. We should drown, just like when you want to get a wasp. Sometimes you put a pot of honey, and they get all sticky, isn't it? They come, and they're eating the honey, they get stuck in the honey. So this is what Lord Chaitanya has done. So four, pure devotional service is really achieved. Five, those in pure devotional service derive even the conception of liberation. And six, pure devotional service is, and this is the most important of all, it is the only means to attract Krishna. You see? It is the only means to attract Krishna. So generally we see that in every religion, the idea is to somehow capture God. We want to capture God by performing some pious activities, by gaining some knowledge, by doing various altruisms and sacrifices and various things like that. But the idea is to capture God. You can never capture God. You can never actually bring God under your subjugation. God will always be billions of miles away, inconceivable distance away. But there is one thing that does attract Krishna, and that is love for Krishna. So this pure devotional service and love is the only thing which actually attracts Krishna. So Krishna is all attractive, but pure devotional service attracts even him. This means that pure devotional service is even transcendentally stronger than Krishna himself, because it is Krishna's internal potency. And that is the point, that this transcendental Krishna consciousness is taking shelter of the internal potency. And because we have taken shelter of the internal potency, therefore this potency is very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. So this is the secret of success of spiritual life. That we are very tiny, we are automatically born into a hellish condition of life, we are deformed by this material body, by these material senses, we have no capacity to approach the Absolute Truth in any shape or form. But if the Absolute Truth descends down, as He has done in this Gaudiya Madhava Vaishnava Sampradaya, then the Personality of Godhead has come within this gopura, within this line, and has revealed Himself, and has given us the opportunity of taking direct shelter of the Lord's internal energy. So that is the unique contribution of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, that He has brought Goloka Premadana. He has brought this rasa of love down in order for us to have a taste. Because without this taste, we can never get out of this material world. So just like I was saying in the beginning of the class, that this principle of sex life is very, very difficult. Unless one is able to cope with this principle, then one cannot actually make advancement in spiritual life. So what is this principle of sex life? That should be understood. The principle of sex life is the perverted manifestation of the love that we have for Krishna. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya has particularly come to show what is real sex life. You see? What is real sex life? There is real sex life and there is perverted sex life. In the material world, this sex life is manifested in the relationship between boy and girl. But in the spiritual world, the pure sex life is manifested in the relationship between the gopis and Krishna. So therefore, we should understand that if we take shelter of Krishna, then we will actually be able to enter in to this transcendental rasa of prema. This transcendental rasa of prema, of pure love for Krishna, is manifested in five different relationships. Of course, there is Shantaras, Dasyaras, and there is Sakyaras, Vatsalyaras, Madhuryaras. So Lord Chaitanya came to open that pot. That pot is the manifestation of the five different relationships. Of course, the particularly four relationships are predominantly explained by the Goswamis. And those relationships are the eternal Rasamrita Sindhu, the eternal. Just when we talk about Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it is the ocean of nectar of giving oneself to Krishna. In most religions, the idea of giving oneself to God is the idea of bowing down to God, isn't it? Just like Allah Akbar. Allah Akbar. Allah Akbar. Isn't it? So we have to stand there, Allah Akbar. Akbar Allah. Isn't it? Because God is great, I should bow. This is a very coarse type of relationship with God. That God, what sort of relationship it is with anyone, where every time you see them, you got to bow down to them. There's no relationship. It is just one of fear, one of anxiety. Just like when you're bowing down to anything, then automatically you're hoping that by the time you get up, they've gone past. Many times when people bow to a sannyasi, you kind of open the way they look up. So this idea of awe and reverence, this is not a very high principle of religiosity, because it is based upon certain conditions. It is based upon certain conditions which are basically phenomenal. Phenomenal conditions. That God is very great, He creates a big universe, and He's got fireballs coming out of His eyes, and He's sitting there damnating everyone. When we commit sins, we should shake in fear, and there will be gnashing of teeth, and the hells will open up, and fire will spew out, and we'll get burnt on the legs, and burnt. But this is not the idea of God. This is a very, very, what is called, mixed up idea, where the idea of God, it is good, obviously, that one is approaching God, at least because one is very simple, one may be approaching God out of fear. But it's not very pleasurable to God. What sort of pleasure does fear give to God? Just like, what sort of pleasure does it give you that people are scared stiff of you? If you go to see your child and the child's pregnant, the child's teeth are gnashing, then you know what sort of relationship would you feel you're having with that child? So this awe and reverence, then a little higher than that, when it becomes a little bit more intimate, then there is servitude, then the idea that I should serve God, God should be served. All the time you're thinking how to serve God. This is nice, but still there lacks some confidentiality there. There is still this idea, there's God, there's me, and there's some service. It is not very confidential, but still it is good. And then even better, when one becomes more confidential, then there is friendship. In friendship, then love can start to gel. Because in friendship, there's all sorts of rasa that goes on, that would not go on in awe and reverence, who would not even go on as servitude. But in friendship, this sakya, then there is sometimes so many different reciprocations. Sometimes the friends massage each other's feet, they lie together, they play together, just like the coward boys, they get on the shoulders of Krishna, they fight Balaram. And Krishna's too slow, you have to push him. Come on, Krishna. So sometimes the friend of Krishna, he takes the dominant position. This is very pleasurable to God, because Krishna is dominating over the whole creation. So domination is not something which Krishna gets special rasa from. But he gets special rasa when he is dominated by his devotee. So when Krishna is, sometimes he's, if you like, almost not abused, but he is told what to do by his devotees, then he gets a very extra special friend. And then when that friendship becomes more and more manifested, the love becomes even deeper in this parental affection, where one feels this urgency or a great need to protect Krishna, to look after Krishna, to cuddle Krishna, so many things, these are in parental. And then when the intimacy becomes even more. So we see that in the gradual progression, there is giving of services to different degrees. So in servitude, one serves Krishna in a certain way, one uses certain items, one uses particular parts of his body to serve Krishna. When one becomes friendship, then there's more intimacy, in offering of one's body to Krishna, in parental affection. There is more interest in intimacy of offering love to Krishna, and in conjugal love there is offering of everything to Krishna. Everything to Krishna. Every single aspect of the gopi's mind, body and everything is usable in Krishna's service. It is there for giving pleasure to Krishna. Therefore, that is why in the material world this sexual rasa is the highest type of material rasa, because it gives pleasure to all the senses. You see, it gives pleasure to all the senses. Of course, these things cannot be understood, because in the material world the performance of so-called sex life is the most abominable and disgusting, because we are using the most horrible materials. The material body is a disgusting, out of all, the most disgusting thing about the body is the lower genitals. So therefore, it is in the material world, we cannot try to begin to understand the different relationship of conjugal love between Krishna and the gopis. This should not be approached. But we can understand that Lord Chaitanya has come to give the absolute truth, and that absolute truth is manifested in absolute surrender unto Krishna. Absolute surrender means where we become the objects of exploitation for Krishna. In the material world, we want every object to be for our exploitation, including God. But in the spiritual science of Krishna consciousness, every single thing becomes for the pleasure of Krishna. And therefore, the different gradations of surrender is manifested in the different rasas which are given in this bhakti rasa and this evening. So, we'll just finish off with a few things that these are verses about Lord Chaitanya's coming. Apani karumo bhakta bhavan vikare apani achari bhakti siddhanu sabare. I shall accept the role of a devotee, and I shall teach devotional service by practicing it myself. O learned Brahmanas, sometimes I accept the renounced order of life to induce the fallen people of the age of Kali to accept devotional service to the Lord. In this way, assuming the sentiment of a devotee, he preached devotional service by practicing it himself. Kama prema dukkakara vibhina lakshane lodarayima yachas parabhavilakshana. Lust and love have different characteristics, just as iron and gold have different natures. The desire to gratify one's own senses is kama, lust, but the desire to please the senses of Lord Krishna is prema, or love. So that is the difference, the scientific difference of Krishna consciousness and any other activity, is that every single thought that comes out of the mind of man and woman is to satisfy oneself. And therefore, every single thought that comes out of your mind is directly opposed to devotional service. So Lord Chaitanya has come to change the mentality of the conditioned souls in Kali Yuga. And that is that one simply has to understand that the desire to gratify one's own senses is called karma, or lust. But the desire to please the senses of Lord Krishna is prema, or love. So therefore, this is the esoteric secret of devotional service, that by engaging one's self in service to Krishna, for the pleasure of Krishna, one automatically becomes free from any desire to enjoy in this material world. One is automatically put onto the transcendental platform of bhakti rasamrita sindhu, of the ocean of pure devotion. The thing is that the mental denial, the psychological denial of God, is just an artificial imposition on the mind, something that we artificially convince ourselves God doesn't exist. But everyone knows they have to grow old, everyone knows they get diseased, everyone knows they die. Everyone ultimately knows that there is. Okay, they can say, I don't believe in God, but they believe in death. They believe in some power of some kind. They believe it. So in one sense, they're just substituting God with some other word or some other energy or some other idea. No, carry on.
Sorry? You wouldn't exactly say that death is a power. You could say that, you know, death comes to all of us. You know, you could be an atheistic argument that you just part of something.
Yeah, but it's not only death that is more powerful than us. Every single thing in this universe is more powerful than us. So in actuality, we can deny, philosophically we can try to deny higher authority, but we are constantly being subjugated to higher authority in one shape or form or another. So it's just a matter of, like Prabhupada says, you are following one person and I'm following another. But the one thing is true about both of us, we're both followers. We're not leaders. We're not leaders. Nobody is actually a independent, if you like, in this world. So without independence, you can never have freedom. You can never have freedom. So no one's free. So we're not free to acknowledge God or deny God. We're not free to do it. We're not free to pass any judgment on God. But the fact of the matter is, we like to, because we feel good about it. We may feel good that we've finally been able to dismiss God by some sort of mental gymnastics or philosophical gymnastics or whatever. But in reality, everyone is subjugated to the conditions of matter. So being subjugated to the conditions of matter is acknowledging God, because you're being controlled by God's energy. So therefore, whether you accept God as the controller behind, in other words, it's like this, Prabhupada used the example. If you're getting beaten by a stick, is it the stick that's beating you, or the person that's holding the stick? So, all atheism is doing is saying God's a stick. Wow! So, they're just getting beaten on the head with sticks. But at least all the theist is doing is saying, well, I know I'm getting beaten by sticks, but I know there's someone holding them. That's all. But whether you deny the owner of the stick, if you're getting beaten to death with a stick, whether you deny that someone's doing it, and you say it's just a stick, or whether you acknowledge that someone's holding the stick and beating you to death, it's basically just the same thing. In that sense. Come on, you don't agree with that, you can argue
with it. I still don't understand the why it's necessary for God to exist if we, just on the basis that we can deny Him. Because we can deny so many things, it doesn't make those things actuality.
We can deny so many things, but you can't deny anything greater than God. You see, the idea of greatness is always the factor of the discussion of God. In other words, that science is being subjugated by the greatness of phenomena. Right? And therefore they can say, I don't believe in God, but I believe in phenomena. That's all they're doing. They just substitute one with the other. But they cannot deny the greatness of phenomena, because they are a very tiny molecular manifestation of phenomena, being subjugated by huge forces all around. So therefore, the idea of denial is doesn't change anything. It just may make them feel good in their head. But it doesn't stop them getting old, getting diseased, dying, not being able to control their bodies, not being able to control their functioning, not being able to control anything. I mean, in reality, if anyone was intelligent as a scientist, he would understand his complete helplessness in this world. Whether he believes that his helplessness is caused by someone or not, at least he has to accept it, his total helplessness. Because the human body is the most pathetic thing in terms of coping with nature. you know, it's just what we call it, we're like little insects wobbling around in this huge ocean of matter, trying to establish some solidity or some permanence or some shelter of some kind.
But when they, if they subjugate to phenomena, they're being controlled by some phenomena, that doesn't, they will say, that doesn't prove that there's a supreme person.
Mm.
What does that, you know, why does that mean?
Well, they may not accept the supreme person.
Why does that be omniscient, omnipotent, and omnipotent?
Yeah.
So why
does that the thing is that they're, the understanding of the cause. Because, I mean, what we're dealing with really is cause and effect, isn't it? So we're studying the effect and then projecting that onto the cause. Now, if the effect is energy, then generally people project the cause as being energy, isn't it? So they say, well, I don't believe in God, but I believe in an energy. So what science has done is just basically reductionism. They have to reduce the cause down to something. So, either so small that you can't talk about it. But all we've done is we've gone the other way. We've macrocosmically manifested and it's so great that you can't talk about it. So they've microcosmically brought him down to a singular, indescribable, indefinable, unknowable, unspeakable, untranscendable, limitedly singular point of immense density, whatever you want to call it. And it's basically just saying the cause of all causes is somewhere in there. And what we're saying is the cause of all causes is somewhere out there. But either way, you have to come to an unlimited point. Whether that point of unlimited source is inconceivably small or inconceivably big. It's all speculation, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Yeah, I agree. Maybe be speculation, but you know, through that has come some result, hasn't it?
What result?
All right, I'll give you an example about the recent cloning of the animals.
DNA.
Yeah. Using DNA to clone. So how could, what would there be another soul that's actually going, that God's actually, you know, overriding the whole situation, overlooking, oh, that there's no soul, just going to put a soul in there?
No, the point is that all science are doing is manipulating an energy which already exists. They're not creating anything.
Yeah.
If they're able to put together certain already existing elements, and just like cloning as an example, DNA already exists. They didn't create DNA, it already exists. All they've done is they found out where it was, right? It's been there for millions of years, but suddenly they found out where it was, and now they're able to take advantage. Just like if you're able to take advantage of sowing seed in the garden and you end up with a big cauliflower. It doesn't mean you've created it. And all you've done is you've taken advantage of something which has been there by already existing powers. So whatever scientists do, they're just children playing with toys. The toys are given by the parent, and then the child plays around and thinks, look, Dad, look what I've done. But you couldn't have done it unless you were given the things to do it with.
But even with the manipulation, you're still being able to create.
It's not creating, it's manipulating. There's a difference between manipulation and creation. If I give you £100 and you go out and spend it, it's not very creative, is it? All you've done is you've taken my £100 of energy and done all sorts of wonderful things with it. But creation means you create everything. In other words, creation means something which comes from nothing. So when scientists can produce something from nothing, because after all, the universe had to come from something. Originally, let's just talk about energy. Let's just say, originally there was nothing, and then there's something.
But they're still giving it a life force.
Giving life.
DNA is dead matter, right? I mean, the DNA of salt, DNA of salt. DNA is the coding, isn't it? Yeah, it's chemicals, right? So from them chemicals, they're creating life. But it's not creating life. Life, isn't it?
As soon as you talk about chemicals, it means something that exists, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you're manipulating chemicals in a certain way, are you saying what you're saying is that they're basically producing life forms?
Mm. Yeah. From chemicals.
Huh?
No.
But
it's
not life.
That's
a
What they have to do is they have to use a living cell. At the present moment, they have to take a living cell and use DNA from another cell to produce the animal or whatever it is. So they still have to use a living cell. But obviously, a living cell doesn't necessarily have to contain that soul to then do it.
Yeah, but if life comes in, if life is there in the cell, then there must be the soul. There can't be life without a soul.
But does that, you may take like, I don't know, any kind of cell, and that doesn't necessarily have to contain the soul which is going to create that being as a soul.
Well,
because then you're elevating that soul from a simple cell to a human being, or a sheep or something, instantly.
The thing is that there are various opportunities of life that are there. Sometimes, as it says, that life is manifested through, of course, the ones we know as there may be eggs. The soul is taking advantage of an egg, and from that egg, in combining with the father's sperm, then the body comes. And then if you go down, there's some life forms that come from sweat, or come from, chemical reactions in fermentation. So if some sort of life form takes opportunity of growing within this single cell, I mean, the thing is that generally, even the egg of the mother, I think, is a single cell. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we also started in a single cell.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, if they managed to produce life from a single cell, it's been going on for billions of years. So what's new?
Would there be a point where, like, if the scientist was to challenge us? Would we be able to draw the line and say, okay, if you take chemicals off the shelf, just chemicals, and create DNA from those chemicals, and then replicate the DNA, create a cell, and then you create life. So you've created life basically just from chemicals on the shelf. Would we say then that we're wrong?
No, because first of all that science is doing is copying something that already exists. So they're cheating to begin with. You know, it's like if someone makes a Ferrari and then I copy a Ferrari and say, I made a Ferrari, the guy will say, well, hang on, I made the first one and you copied me. So that, to begin with, is just copying. They're copycat. So they're not scientists, because a scientist is someone who creates from nothing something. The only scientist is God. Because you have to have nothing, and then from that nothing, you produce something. So what they're doing, basically, it's like aerodynamics. They make an airplane and everyone says, oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. But there are billions of airplanes on this planet. There's little mosquito airplanes, there's bird airplanes, there's all sorts of airplanes flying around since thousands of years. So man is very proud that they put an airplane up, but in actuality, where did they get all their knowledge from? What is already aerodynamically existing, birds and insects and everything like that. And even they admit that with all their sophistication, they still can't imitate nature. Because if you look at something like the, what is that insect, the that one that's always going around ponds, and it hovers, Dragonflies. They can't even begin to imagine the aerodynamics of that. The dragonflies. They can just stand in awe and look at them.
But then hasn't our challenge always been to scientists that life comes from life and you cannot create life? That's always been what I've perceived.
Yeah, life comes from life. Without the ingredients of life, the body cannot grow. But the even if scientists were able to create the right circumstances for life to occupy that particular thing, then, just for instance, it's like in the womb of the mother, all of these chemical things are going on. So if you take it out of the womb and put it on a plate, what's the big deal? All you've done is you transfer the same process out of what's already been going on inside the womb, and you've created an artificial womb, and you've made the same. So it's simply again, you're just imitating something that's already going on. You haven't created a new formula. I think if scientists were able to go like that, and in their hand a little baby came, then you could talk about creation. But if they're taking anything from nature, all they're doing is they're thieves.
Even the scientists, they admit themselves they have this statement, matter cannot be created or destroyed. They say that.
Yeah.
So even if they're saying that if you create life from matter, but they're saying themselves that matter cannot be created or destroyed in the first place. They're admitting that they can't create matter.
Yeah.
But the challenge has always been is that science cannot create life from matter. That's always been our. So what we're saying now is that was a meaningless challenge in the first place.
No, because that challenge still stands, because the difference between taking life and extracting life from it and taking chemicals and extracting chemicals, even if it's like cellular level, is huge.
No, that's what I'm saying. Is that if I'm not saying that they can do it now, I'm saying they've already created DNA in the laboratory. So if they now begin to replicate that DNA,
they haven't created DNA.
More than that, they've created DNA.
Chemicals to make the structure. But what you're trying to say is that if they build a body, but they can't inject the life.
No, but what I'm saying is that. See, we're saying injecting life, but what I'm saying is that they don't believe you're injecting life. They're saying that you just life is manifest through a combination of DNA.
From where?
Through the combination of chemicals. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying, is that if they do that, are we saying that we're wrong?
Go one further. Take a dead body and inject your DNA, get it going again. When they can do that, then we'll accept that they've come to somewhere close towards creating life. So, why worry about making all the chemicals? The chemicals are already there in the dead body. Why don't they just get, there's millions of dead bodies, just get one of them and put their DNA chemical in it and get it up and running again? Why wouldn't that be possible? If all the chemicals are already there and life was there only a second ago, then surely they should be able to readjust the chemicals quickly and get the old thing going again, boom, 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 boom.
It's a much more complex body than a single cell one.
Huh?
It's a much more complex body than a single cell.
Yeah, but all of the chemicals have already happened in it. It had life a second ago, just like a car. The car breaks down, then any good mechanic knows that if it was working a few moments ago, that it's generally, you can quickly trace back to why it stopped, because there's certain mechanisms that make it run. So similarly, if they know the mechanisms that make things create life, then they should just inject those chemicals in, and off they go. They can inject one cell in, but if that one cell can create life, then life's the thing which is going to bring the living force to the body, then it should work. We don't mind.
Well, he's wondering, as well as the integrity of our argument that we have for, that you can't produce life from chemicals. And so far, obviously they can't produce life.
No, but what I'm saying is that they've produced DNA.
Yeah,
they produce the structure of DNA from chemicals off the shelf.
Not from a cell or
nothing. No, not from a cell, from shelf chemicals they produce DNA.
And that DNA will produce a living body, that's what I'm saying.
Where do they get the chemicals from the shelf?
Okay, I said that, but our argument has always been life from chemicals. We never said you have to create the chemicals.
Now we're changing our argument. Yeah, no.
I thought our argument was life comes from life.
Yeah.
And if the scientists are alive,
no, but they still have to create life. Life from and see.
So
there's two classes of scientists. One is theist and one is atheist. If you look at the world, you see there's two different classes. Some will disagree with you and some will agree with you. The atheists will agree with you. They have a completely different perception. One is logical and the other is illogical. You can argue, you can say, okay, what if we do go to the moon and eventually we find life there? You know, yeah, what if you do? You know, you could create life there. Yeah, you could control the universe. You could create everything.
I don't see how that contradicts our philosophy. Yeah. If the scientists are alive, they have life, and they can create life. Life comes from life.
No,
man and woman have created life.
That's the point.
There's
such a difference between where we're at now and the fact that we're actually producing
life and chemicals. See, DNA always exists within the structure of the cell, which has life in it. It operates within the life framework.
No, I agree with that. All I'm saying is that are we making a challenge that we're going to back down from? Or are we making a challenge that we're going
to
see?
No, because they've been making the same argument for years. I mean, years ago they were able to, you know, they were able to breed different breeds by, you know, some selection, unnatural selection. And they were saying, well, we can do that, so in the future we'll be able to make life. So now, you know, they haven't come to the point of creating life and chemicals. You know what I mean? You can say it's not close, but it's...
No, I accept that. I'm not saying that they have. I'm just saying, is that what is our argument? Do we accept that they're right if they do
say it's different? See, one point is that...
What's your argument?
Mr. Bodhi's point here is very good, that they're alive. So because they're alive, they're able to produce some situation which comes... It's just like a mother and father. They're both alive. But they're not actually producing life. There's a soul entering the womb. But they can't say that they're producing life. So the scientists are alive as well in the same way. But they can't claim that they're producing life.
They're just manipulating chemicals in a different way than we are.
But that sounds like a change of our
argument. Exactly.
Yeah,
that's what I'm
saying. Yeah, that's the life comes from life.
The original concept is actually a speculation. The scientists have speculated that the origin of life has come from this, what they call the amino acid soup. Basically, DNA is made up of various molecules, and they have speculated that by random chance these molecules have banged into each other, and from that process cells have formed. But that's just a speculation. There's no evidence, it has never been seen, that a cell can form just from the DNA molecules. DNA operates within the framework of a cell, which has the life force in it.
Prabhupada says you can leave a motorbike on the road for millions of years, but if nobody comes along and jumps on the motorbike and drives it, then a living person gets on the motorbike and drives the motorbike off. So the scientists are living persons and they have all these things. So they're making something happen with it because they're alive. It's not that they're all, you know, that the chemicals are doing all these things by themselves. But that just the fact that the scientists are alive is proof that he's a higher substance. He himself is spirit. He's the spirit that's actually manipulating.
And even if they do create the right circumstances for life to come in, they still can't identify what is that thing that comes in. Mm-hmm. Just like if you make a house and someone comes and lives in it, right? If you know the person that comes in and lives there, if you see them, then you know what's coming, what's living in the house. So, but with them, even if they created the house, when someone does come in and live in it, they still don't know what it is that's coming and living there. Because that thing which is living, when it leaves the body, they don't know what it is. They don't know what it is. Yeah, until they're able to actually replace that thing which leaves. In other words, let's say you can't see the living force, but you can see it when it leaves. You can see that there's certain changes in the actual appearance of the body. So therefore, if you really know what it is that leaves, you should be able to put it back in again. That's logical. Yeah. If you really know what life is, then you know what's just left, the body. Whether it's an ant body or a what is a little fly, a fruit fly body. Once that fruit fly body has stopped going to the machine, you know, there's a certain point, then you should be able to put that thing back into it and get it back working. But the fact of the matter is, suppose you create a fruit fly cell, and a living force takes up that fruit fly cell and becomes a fruit fly. Well, all you've done is what's been going on for thousands of years, which is creating the circumstances for fruit flies, which nature's been doing. So, what's new? What's new about that? But if you don't actually have the thing which you add to the fruit fly, which makes it flap around in the sky, then until you have that thing, until you know what it is, you don't know what life is. So even if you create a fruit fly, suddenly you've got a fruit
fly. And what the cook is concerned about the breakfast getting cold.
Oh, yeah. Okay, Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita Ki Jai.